This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. President George Washington is well known for his leadership during the Revolutionary War and his foresight as commander-in-chief to set wise precedents. What is not as well known about him is his status as a slaveholder. In her new book, author Erica Armstrong Dunbar writes about Ona Judge, a slave who successfully escaped from the president's home and made a life for herself on New Hampshire's seacoast. Never caught, the Washington's relentless pursuit of their runaway slave, Ona Judge, is a story about slavery, American society, our first president, and the human desire for freedom. Let's hear from you. The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is nhprexchange@nhpr.org. You can also join the conversation on Facebook or on Twitter at nhprexchange. Erica Armstrong Dunbar will be speaking tonight at 5:30 at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord, and she has a few other New Hampshire speaking engagements lined up as well. You can learn more about those at our website, nhpr.org. But right now, we've got Erica Armstrong Dunbar with us. Erica, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start by talking about how we came to know about all this, your research on Ona Judge. She was illiterate, so she didn't write a memoir of anything like this. At least she was illiterate in the first part of her life. Mm-hmm. But she was sort of interviewed by a journalist, and that's how we come to know most of this story. But tell us about your research. How did we get to know this woman and her story?
Yeah, it's her story, every time I talk about it, even though I've been working on this project, this book now for more than almost 9 years. Every time I talk about her and think about her, it's more amazing every day. Luckily for us, she did give two interviews at the end of her life. And those interviews allow us to have a sort of portal or a window into her experiences, her thoughts, her feelings as a fugitive. The story is sort of flanked by Washington's writings and his account books and secondhand accounts from others who lived in Portsmouth or Philadelphia or Mount Vernon. So it took a significant amount of time to pull back the curtain on her life, but it was worth it every mm-hmm. moment.
And certainly there were also newspaper advertisements for both when she escaped mm-hmm. and then later when she was a free woman and she was married.
Yeah. So what's interesting is that although Ona Judge was a fugitive for more than half a century, she does appear in print on several occasions. One, as you said, when she first runs away, and later on as she starts to build a life for herself, a marriage announcement makes its way to the newspaper. And then sort of markers of her life later on, her family and her own sort of moments in life, of course, the interviews and her obituary.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to the beginning and orient ourselves with mm-hmm. Ona Judge as a young person. She mm-hmm. she was born into slavery. Tell us how she grew up and how she ended up with the Washingtons.
Sure. So Ona Judge was born at Mount Vernon. Washington didn't keep a record of birth dates for the enslaved at Mount Vernon. So our best guess is that she was born sometime in 1773 or 74. And she was born to a woman named Betty, who was also referred to on occasion as Mulatto Betty. She actually was the property, human property, of Martha Washington. And Martha Washington was married before George Washington. That was her second husband. Mm-hmm. And so he had died, and as a widow, she inherited a great deal of wealth, including slaves, brought Ona's mother to Mount Vernon in 1759 when she married, and eventually Betty would have other children, but Ona Judge was one of them. Ona is unlike many of the others who were enslaved in Mount Vernon in that she has a surname, and her surname was Judge. And so her father was named Andrew Judge, and he was a white indentured servant who was a tailor at Mount Vernon, the only person with the last name Judge in all of Fairfax County. So I was able to piece together her parentage. And she basically, she is born at Mount Vernon. And by the age of 10, she's chosen to come up to what they called the Mansion House to serve Martha Washington.
Mm-hmm. And what did she do there?
So she, you know, at the age of 10, that's sort of when childhood ended for many of the enslaved, whether you were going to the house or doing agricultural work. She was taught to sew. She was a seamstress, as was her mother and her sisters, and a spinner. But she was also learning how to basically become a domestic slave. And what the book does is try to explain and some, kind of break down some myths about what it meant to be an enslaved person in the house and how difficult that labor was and how unyielding it was. And eventually for Ona, she becomes Martha Washington's, for the lack of a better phrase, top slave.
Almost like a personal assistant.
But enslaved, yes.
But enslaved, yes.
Yeah, that's she. Clearly, she was responsible for the most intimate of duties. So helping Martha Washington bathe, helping her with her clothes selection and repairing her clothing as well, helping her brush her hair, and then sort of just being on call for her constantly. And this was at Mount Vernon. And then later on when the Washingtons would travel, Ona would still participate in those kinds of responsibilities.
I think you wrote that there were something like 160 slaves on Mount Vernon at the time.
Yeah, and then by the end of George Washington's life, there were over 300 enslaved people. So we see it, in some ways it mirrors what's happening with slavery in the nation, that the new, what becomes the new nation, slavery is growing, and we see it grow at Mount Vernon as well.
Mm-hmm. So Ona worked inside, but there were slaves working outside as well. Compare the two lifestyles. Yeah. Was it equally difficult, or was there one that was more difficult than the other?
Yeah. Well, like I said, what I wanted to do was to use Ona's experience to break down this myth about it being a sort of better existence or an easier existence to be, quote, a house slave. You know, I take issue with that, and I think that they were different situations. For those who were engaged in agricultural work, whether they were growing tobacco or wheat or corn, you know, this was a kind of work that required them sort of working outside, sun up, sundown. And for Ona Judge and the others who were domestic slaves who worked in the house, they found themselves doing work from beginning to the end of the day and beginning of the day to the end of the day. But for Ona, she lived with her owners, and she didn't have kind of the slave quarters to return to breathe and live and love. Independently, she was sort of always around, at least when they move from Mount Vernon, that's the case. So I don't make the argument that one is better or worse than. They're different.
Mm-hmm. And listeners, if you have questions about the way slavery worked at this point in time in American culture or about Ona Judge, give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also write us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Erica Armstrong Dunbar, I wanted to ask you about slavery laws back mm-hmm. at this point in American history. I mean, we're talking about Virginia, so tell us about Virginia's laws at the time. What were they?
Yeah, the laws in Virginia developed over time regarding slavery. And often when I'm teaching my undergraduates, there's the myth that slavery begins in Virginia, or African slavery in America begins in Virginia. And that's actually incorrect. When we think about it, the first colony to legalize African slavery was Massachusetts, mm-hmm. not Virginia. And it would take really more than 50 years for Virginia to come up with a set of slave codes. And basically, by the time Ona's born, it's understood that enslaved people would inherit their status based upon the status of their mother, so that slavery followed the apron strings of its women. Mm-hmm. And that as you could be purchased, mortgaged, bartered, traded, for whatever your owner deemed appropriate. And so that by the 18th century, African slavery has become much more solidified in the nation.
Mm-hmm. And this was before the Federal Fugitive Slave Act that when Washington later became president, he signed into law. We will get to that in a bit. But essentially, at this point, the states were making their own slavery laws, correct?
Pretty much, yeah. And as we see by the era of the Revolution, for the most part, all of the states, the colonies at that point, had laws about slavery. And then what happens with this revolution, this sort of fight for freedom, is that we see northern states in particular begin to question African enslavement and to begin to dismantle the system. So it becomes thorny and it's difficult while southern states are enforcing slave codes. We see something very different happening in places like Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and later on other northern colonies that would become states.
Mm-hmm. So back to the question of George and Martha Washington, they were living under Virginia's laws at the time. Mm-hmm. How did they interact with their slaves? How did they interact with Ona Judge?
Yeah. One thing we get a sense of how George Washington interacts with his enslaved men and women through his own words, through his records, through the account ledgers. We knew that he had a relatively close, I'll call it, relationship between himself and his sort of top body slave, William Lee, who would journey with him all across Virginia and other places. Martha Washington was less open, or at least wrote less, and, you know, she burned the majority of the correspondence between herself and Washington after Washington's death. So we have less in the way of knowledge about her feelings, but from what we've been able to see, she's less favorable and or connected to the enslaved at Mount Vernon. She's overseeing them. She's working with them, but clearly believes that they are inferior to white people.
Wow. Okay. We've got a call from Stan in Epsom. Stan, welcome to The Exchange. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Yes, actually, it's Dan, but that's okay. I read, actually, sometime back, one of the biographers of Washington, and he talked about how Martha Washington had a seamstress that she had trained and how, as he put it, this young woman thanked her by running away. And I finally realized this is who he was talking about, mm-hmm. is this woman that you've done this wonderful biography on. I'm amazed at this. But what's amazing to me is that you found her, yeah. whereas even the biographer didn't. I could say a lot more about this, but one of the things he noted was how Washington's death had over 300 slaves. He said the reason for this was Washington would not break up the families, that was repugnant to him. He would not sell off individual slaves, even though Thomas Jefferson, who was a slave owner, did. Mm-hmm. So even though you can't, well, I don't know, I think everybody wrestles with Washington owning slaves, but I guess if you can say the one redeemable fact is that apparently he thought it was awful to sell off the family members. So this is why he had, at the time of his death, this enormous number of people under his, I don't know if you've heard of this before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, let's put that question to Eric Armstrong Dunbar. What about Washington's reputation as someone who didn't want to break up slave families? Does that hold water with you?
Yeah. So thanks, Dan, for the question. And for the comments, and yeah, this is the same person that biographers have offered a little bit of time to, Ona Judge. Washington has sort of earned this reputation for being someone who was loath to separate families. But what I kind of argue in the book is that while he was hesitant to sell off members of enslaved people who were families, he did separate them in terms of the farms. I mean, there were over 5 farms at Mount Vernon. So it was quite possible that a husband and a wife were not on the same farm, and so therefore were not really living with each other. I also want to sort of comment about his will, Washington's will, and also about slave ownership at Mount Vernon. One thing that's important to note is that Martha Washington was the larger slave owner between herself mm-hmm. and George Washington. So at the time of Washington's death, he does emancipate over 120 people that were technically his property. And he does that. I ask the question in the book, you know, George and Martha Washington never had biological children together. Martha did, but had her own children, but George did not. And, you know, I ask this question, how likely would he have been to have let go of such significant wealth if he had sons and daughters who were sort of expecting it? He had heirs, but not children of his own. And I think that helped prompt him to release his men and women who were in bondage. But an important note is that they had intermarried with the enslaved of Martha Washington. So when they were set free and Martha Washington's were not, families were broken apart.
Mm-hmm. And it's worth mentioning, too, not that this is an excuse for his slavery, but he was not a wealthy man. He actually was, as far as you describe in your book, Erica, pretty cash-strapped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was. And, you know, that wasn't sort of unusual at that moment in time with a new nation that nobody knew if it was going to work or not. And everybody was sort of cash-strapped, especially Washington. He had to borrow money when he went to New York to become the nation's president. But I do think that's an important thing to mention, that Martha Washington really brought the majority of the wealth to the family, and that was through land, but also enslaved people. And so this idea of transfer of wealth, in particular through enslaved people, Washington could do whatever it was that prompted him to emancipate men and women in his will, I think because he had no children.
Mm-hmm. And one of the, pardon me, one of the attitudes he had toward slavery in general and his slaves in particular was that, as you write, Eric Armstrong Dunbar, that he thought the freedom might be bad for them, mm-hmm. that they may have a worse life as free people, either in Virginia or wherever they happen to want to go with their mm-hmm. freedom, than they would have as slaves on Mount Vernon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that becomes sort of the paternalistic cover that the majority of slave owners who did fashion themselves as benevolent, Washington did, of course, they suggested that they took care of their slaves, that they took care of the men and women. They treated them almost like family members, and that to unleash them to have to take care of themselves would almost be cruel, that they were being fed and clothed. And so this was the kind of justification that was often lodged in order to protect Southern slavery rights, right? This becomes an excuse. And Washington, whether or not he actually believed that to be true, I think he probably did believe he was a pretty benevolent slave owner. But if you asked any of the men and women who lived at Mount Vernon, you know, I think that their responses to what freedom, if they should be given freedom, I think it would have been different than George's.
Right. If they had asked, sure, do you want freedom? He may have been surprised at their answer.
Every time.
Or maybe not. Maybe he knew and just didn't want to ask mm-hmm. because he knew they would want freedom. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that it's a gap in history, right? We don't have an actual record of that particular question.
Well, we do know his estate manager does tell him, especially as he moves north, that he needs to be alert because he doubts whether or not the enslaved will give up the opportunity to be free.
Huh. Well, and shortly after becoming, well, not shortly after becoming president, but after becoming president, Ona Judge starts to reconsider whether she wants to be his slave. And we'll take a look at that in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Feel free to join the conversation. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. We're speaking with Erica Armstrong Dunbar, author of Never Caught, the story of Ona Judge, who escaped from President Washington. We'll be right back. Poet Eva Kruschill writes in her most recent collection about the history of American immigration.
And I think it's funny that history repeats itself, and that as soon as we get legalized, we tend to distance ourselves from those people who are not legalized yet, but they have something to tell us.
This week on The Bookshelf from NHPR, Eva Kruschill on poetry and immigration. Subscribe to The Bookshelf from NHPR wherever you get your podcasts. And this is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoy, and we are talking today with Erica Armstrong Dunbar, the author of Never Caught: Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. And if you have a question for Erica Armstrong Dunbar, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And I wanted to start this part of the conversation, Erica, with a look at what happened when George Washington was elected president and he had to leave Virginia. Tell us about what that would mean for his slave Ona Judge.
Yeah. So in 1789, George Washington is elected president and the nation's capital is in New York. And so he's really reluctant, actually, to become the first president. And when we think about who the sort of myth of George Washington as the great president, great first president, I think it's always really interesting to think about his own misgivings and his own fear and concerns about running this brand new nation. And so he goes north, and he actually, he goes alone. Martha doesn't go with him when he goes up to New York to take the oath of office, and she's reluctant to go. She's concerned about her husband's health. She felt like they had spent so much time apart during the American Revolution, and so she kind of drags her feet, but eventually heads north. And when they go, they take with them a piece of home and a piece of their sort of Southern sensibilities, and that they took 7 enslaved people with them. And of those 7, Ona Judge was one. Mm-hmm. And she was about the age of 16. She was leaving everything that she knew behind, her mother, most of her siblings, one sort of lucky piece of fortune for her was that her brother, Austin, would travel with them and serve as a waiter. And she would travel to New York. There were 2 women and 5 enslaved men who went to New York to basically care for the Washingtons. And they did so in conjunction with white servants in the North. And so this was a completely different experience for Ona. Not only was she leaving behind everything that she knew, she was leaving behind a Mount Vernon, a Southern life, a life in Virginia, for this new and kind of bustling city of New York.
Right. And what were the slavery laws in New York like at the time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So New York was in the midst of kind of grappling with the issue of slavery. And by 1789, there was conversation about maybe having some kind of gradual emancipation that actually doesn't happen until about a decade later and isn't enforced until some time thereafter. But there were definitely a number of people who questioned slavery and who had created abolition societies and were helping to assist fugitives and others who were, they felt, wrongfully held as enslaved people. And so I think one thing that's important to note is that when Ona arrives in New York, she arrives in a New York where there are free black people, but there are definitely a number of enslaved people. So as George and Martha Washington brought their men and women with them, it wasn't particularly odd that they did so. There were a number of politicians, the governor of New York, others who did have slaves. And I think that that sentiment, that situation changes when they go to Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. And so this is the first time Ona Judge may have seen free black people moving about town. Did this, in your opinion, sort of plant the seed mm-hmm. in Ona Judge to say, hey, maybe I could be free like them someday?
Mm-hmm. I think it definitely it augmented what I believe she already knew, because there were people who, enslaved men and women, who ran off from Mount Vernon, you know, years before George Washington was tracking people down during the colonial period. And so there was always this understanding that there was another place, another way to live. And during the American Revolution, some of Washington's slaves ran off to fight with the British because they were promised their freedom. So I think Ona and others at Mount Vernon knew this story, but when she came to New York, she actually saw it play out in front of her own eyes. And I think that becomes even more obvious when she moves to Philadelphia. But it's definitely, of course, it affects her frame of reference.
Mm. Tell us why it was more obvious in Philadelphia.
Yeah, so the nation's capital moves, and for all the Hamilton fans who are familiar with the story of the relocation of the nation's capital, it moves to Philadelphia in 1790. And so Ona and eight other enslaved people, the numbers actually pick up a bit. The Washingtons take nine people to Philadelphia at different times. And here in Philadelphia, slavery was really on its deathbed. And Pennsylvanians had passed a law in 1780 that began the gradual emancipation or the dismantling of slavery. And so the law stated that you could only hold a person in human bondage for up to 28 years. And so 28 years, that's a long time during mm-hmm. the sort of early national period. But it was more than a gesture that slavery would come to an end. So by the time that she arrives in Philly, the majority of people are free. She's in the minority as an enslaved person.
Mm-hmm. And another quirk of Pennsylvania, or at least Philadelphia law at the time, was it state law?
Yeah.
It was the whole state,
Pennsylvania.
Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, is that slaves couldn't be held for, there was a six-month rule, right? Tell us about the six-month rule.
Yeah, this was a law that gave George and Martha Washington a lot to kind of think about and worry about. The law in Pennsylvania stated that you could, as a non-resident, visit Pennsylvania, and you could bring your enslaved men and women with you, but you could not stay for more than 6 months. And if you did, the enslaved men and women had the right to freedom. And so when Washington becomes very clear about what the law is, his attorney general says, some of my slaves have run off because we've been in Philly too long, and you need to be careful. There's correspondence that goes back and forth between George Washington, Tobias Lear, his secretary, and Martha Washington that sort of calculate a plan to rotate their slaves. And so I argue that this doesn't necessarily break the law, but it breaks the spirit of the law. So he rotates nine enslaved people back and forth between Virginia and Pennsylvania. And if they couldn't get to Virginia, a quick trip to New Jersey would basically reset the clock.
Mm-hmm. And you write in this book that in general, there were people in Philadelphia at the time who relied in some part on the slaves not knowing about this mm-hmm. law, and that in at least one case, a slave owner was surprised when one day their slave stood up and said, "Oh, it's been 6 months. I'm free. What you going to do about it?"
Yeah, it's sort of that. I think there was a combination of feeling as though perhaps they were benevolent slave owners, also understanding that the majority of enslaved people could not read or write, and therefore it was believed that they didn't know the law, and. You know, in some cases, they kind of just got a little too loose with their human property. And they are proven time and time again that when given the opportunity, enslaved men and women took the chance, took the risk, wanted to be free. And we see that eventually with Ona.
Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. If you have questions about Ona Judge, about American society in the late 18th century, about President George Washington and his wife Martha and how they handled slaves, the number to call is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us at theexchange@nhpr.org as well. And we've got Jonathan in Portsmouth on the line. Hi, Jonathan. What's your question or comment?
Hey, how are you? So I was on my way. I was on the highway when I first heard this story, or when I first heard this program. But we actually did a play called Thirst for Freedom at the Players' Ring right around 2000. I think it was fall of 2000, and it was about Ona Judge. And I played a smaller part. I played Burwell Bassett, who was sent to retrieve her. And the play was very Portsmouth-centric, so it was an original play written by Emery Wilson. And it was the first play that they did at the Players' Ring after the death of the Players' Ring's founder, Gary Newton. But it was a great show. As far as the history goes, it was a great show. It was an original, but it really did discuss the whole sort of tension that existed between people who wanted to think of themselves as I guess, righteous and those who actually were. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know if you folks knew about the play.
I didn't, but I'll put the question to Erica. Erica, have you heard about this play, Thirst for Freedom?
I did. I heard about the play, and I also, you know, over my sort of multiple research trips to Portsmouth, I've talked to a number of people involved in trying to sort of reclaim and mark Ona's life, whether it's through the theater or through kind of online exhibits. There were a couple that were posted and up for some time. And I think what's so interesting is that all of this kind of culminated in sort of markers around an African burial ground in Portsmouth and a real willingness, I felt, to engage in this question about slavery and freedom in a place like Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And so when I began my research and coming to Portsmouth, the city actually technically looked different than what it does now, considering that there are markers for that recognize people of African descent and their lives, Ona sort of being one of them. So I'm grateful to the community in Portsmouth for wanting, really being sort of early and wanting to tell this story.
Mm-hmm. So Ona Judge was a slave for all of her life, and including when she arrived in Philadelphia with the president and his people. What made her decide, I've had enough, I don't want to be a slave anymore, I'm going to make my escape? What made her decide to do that?
Yeah, I think there are a number of things that come into play that sort of pull the trigger on Ona's decision. And aside from living with free Black people, aside from seeing the agency of Black entrepreneurs in the streets of Philadelphia who were selling their pepper pot soup and their fruits and their vegetables, or building Black churches and living as free people, you know, these are all, this influences her. She lives also, and I think it's important to note, with free white servants in the house. And so I don't think it's just a conversation about Black freedom. I think it's a conversation about the freedom of one over labor and this, the right to earn a wage, a wage labor. And that's the moment in which Ona makes this decision to leave. We see that coming to fruition. But in actuality, it's the decision made by Martha Washington to give Ona Judge away. And she made a decision to give her top slave away to her granddaughter. I don't want to tell everything because I do want listeners to buy the book. But
oh, come on, you should tell us.
We'll say.
Let's say the granddaughter was not someone that Ona Judge had the stomach to work for. She, to some degree, respected the Washingtons, but not the granddaughter.
She was concerned about what would happen once she was given over to this granddaughter, who was about the same age as Ona Judge. And I think all of these things coming together, knowing that she would, and she figured fairly soon, be sent to work under the granddaughter, that she would be leaving the North, a place that had really been her home, I think, at a critical moment in her life. It's, you know, as a teenager, what we call a teenager now, in her kind of early 20s, she sort of came into adulthood in a free state. And to think about having to go back to the South and working under this granddaughter, that was something that Ona Judge simply couldn't stomach. And she says later on in one of these interviews, you know, I simply refuse to be her slave.
Specifically, the granddaughter was
exactly.
Just not someone she wanted to do that for. Mm-hmm. You mentioned labor earlier. I just wanted to ask you about whether or not there were slaves who continued the same kind of work but under different circumstances after, let's say, they were emancipated. Did they accept pay for the same kind of work and come and go as they pleased?
Yeah, I think what's interesting looking at a place like Philadelphia is you see the transition, you know, that it's not people are slaves one day and then they're free the next. And in places like Philly, we see this transition. And oftentimes people who were enslaved moved into indentured servitude for a while. and then eventually found their way to freedom. It's a process, and it's a process that takes decades, really. So that it's 1780 when Pennsylvanians make this law, but really slavery isn't eradicated from Pennsylvania until much later into the early 19th century. So it's a process, and they most often, these folks are finding themselves doing the same types of work, women in particular. So in a city like Philadelphia, it meant that you were a domestic. It meant that you were washing clothes by hand in the 18th century. It meant that you were cooking, that you were cleaning, that you were helping to take care of children. And it also meant sort of working in the shops and small businesses of Philadelphians. So the labor that folks were enforced or were forced to do, we see spill over into freedom.
Mm-hmm. And so she eventually found her freedom in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. Tell us how she escaped and how she got to Portsmouth.
So, Ona's very careful in her interviews later on. She doesn't give many names away, and she doesn't in terms of those who help her to escape. She doesn't because she understands that it's a federal crime to assist in aiding and abetting a runaway. And so she's very clear, though, that it's the free black community of Philadelphia that basically comes to her rescue. And she says in this interview, I didn't know where I was going. I was packing my things, and the Washingtons, we were packing for them to go as well. They were going back to Virginia for the summer. And she says, I didn't know where I was actually going to go. But I knew that if I went back to Virginia, I would never have the chance to get my freedom. And so she takes her belongings to unnamed free black associates, and she waits for the word. She waits for the moment for them to tell her, okay, and they've planned her escape. And so what's so very interesting is that she does not reveal those names. In the book, I make some suggestions about who I believe was involved in her escape, sort of prominent black Philadelphians. The one name she does give us is the name of John Bowles, who was a sea captain. And she says very clearly that she gives his name because he's deceased and so therefore protected, wouldn't be sort of charged with a fine or something for breaking the law. But I was able to, from that bit of information, track the ships that he sailed from Portsmouth to New York, to Philadelphia. And indeed, there's a record of John Bowles being in Philadelphia in May of 1796 with his ship called the Nancy. And that was the ship that she fled to freedom on.
Mm-hmm. And so on the Nancy, she makes her way to Portsmouth. In just a few minutes, we're going to get into some of the details about Ona Judge's life in Portsmouth as she tries to navigate her first few days and, of course, the years to come as a free woman. And you can join the conversation about Ona Judge and life in early America. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email. The address is exchange@NHPR. We're speaking with Erica Armstrong Dunbar about her book, Never Caught, which is about George Washington's pursuit of a runaway slave. Join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. Poet Eva Kruschill writes in her most recent collection about the history of American immigration.
And I think it's funny that history repeats itself and that as soon as we get legalized, we tend to distance ourselves from those people who are not legalized yet, but they have something to tell us.
This week on The Bookshelf from NHPR, Eva Kruschill on poetry and immigration. Subscribe to The Bookshelf from NHPR wherever you get your podcasts. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoy. And we are talking today with Erica Armstrong Dunbar. She's the author of Never Caught: The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. And we want you to join the discussion. If you have questions, call us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us at exchange@nhpr.org. When we left the break, we had just talked about Ona Judge's arrival in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, as she was beginning her life as a free woman, a fugitive slave, trying to escape capture of President George Washington, whose home she had departed furtively and took a boat all the way up to Portsmouth, New Hampshire from Philadelphia. Erica Armstrong Dunbar, after Washington realized Ona Judge was gone, what did he do?
Yeah, it's, Ona runs away while they were eating their supper, while the Washingtons were eating their supper on May 21st, 1796. Within 2 days, there are advertisements listed in two newspapers in Philadelphia. And there were runaway slave advertisements for Ona Judge. And in these advertisements, she's often always called Oney Judge. I think that's this kind of important thing to know, because some listeners, especially those in New Hampshire that may be more familiar with her story, they see the name Oney. And I argue in the book that Oney was the diminutive of her name, like my little Oney. And I actually chose to go by Ona, which was the name she used at the end of her life. And so in these slave advertisements, it described Oney Judge, that she had run off. And what's so interesting is that the advertisements say, you know, without the least provocation, that, you know, there's this sort of reminder that the Washingtons did not believe that there was any reason for an enslaved person to run off.
Mm-hmm. And was this a scandal for the Washingtons, their slave publicly running away from them?
I don't know if it was so much a scandal. I think that, you know, the Washingtons had lost enslaved people before. I think that George Washington in particular was in an interesting kind of position. He had already, when she ran off, he had already made the decision that he wasn't going to run again for office, that he was only going to be in office another 7-8 months. And I think the importance of image making becomes sort of important for him, that he thinks quite a bit about what the public relations nightmare could really develop if he went after Ona Judge or any enslaved person in states that were clearly reconsidering slavery. Mm-hmm. He had signed into act the Fugitive Slave Law of 1793, giving federal teeth and enforcement to slave owners going and recollecting or collecting their slaves who'd run off. But he knew, having lived in the North, that there were sensibilities that he wasn't willing to tread too difficultly by. He was sensitive to it. And so it wasn't so much a scandal, but I thought, wow, okay, he ran two ads in newspapers for over the course of a week for her.
Wow, okay. We have a question emailed from Kyle, who says, why did the Washingtons want Ona Judge back so badly if they had so many slaves? Kyle emailed, losing one can't hurt them that badly. So comment on that. Yeah. Why would they relentlessly pursue her?
Yeah, I think that, that's a question we all kind of ask ourselves. Well, what was it about Ona? In part because, all right, she ran off and they placed a runaway ad for her. But we know that basically George Washington and Martha Washington, and I really see them as a team here in trying to recapture Ona, that they pretty much do it until the end of their lives. They are relentless in their pursuit. And I think that's more of the question. Why so relentless? And was Washington this way with others who had run off? And, you know, in many ways, I think this was a moment that tested the president's power as a slaveholder, as the president of the United States, to have a 22-year-old enslaved black woman resist him and be successful didn't sit well with him. It didn't sit well with Martha. And Martha was angry. She felt betrayed. Mm-hmm. They pretty much write as they write this, that Washington always writes in his correspondence, my wife is very desirous of seeing her again. And although there are over 300 enslaved people, Ona is someone they're running after. The next question that usually comes after the one that Kyle has just presented is, was there a sexual encounter between George and Ona? And the reality is we don't know. It's never mentioned. Ona never comments upon this in any of her interviews. Clearly, George Washington did not. And in some ways, when we think about that, because of what we know about Jefferson and Sally Hemings, right? So mm-hmm. we know that slavery was based upon rape and forced breeding. And so our mind takes us there. And in some ways, I'm kind of glad that I didn't find this evidence, because I think in some ways it makes her story more compelling, that she wanted freedom because she believed it to be her right, not necessarily that she was running from George Washington or any other man she may have been that might have played into her escape, but it's never spoken.
Okay, and I'm going to paraphrase a comment or question from Alexander from Carroll. Does her running away not sort of undermine the idea that George Washington professed that he had a safe haven mm-hmm. for slaves? Does that not undermine that idea?
Sure, it does. Yeah. And I think it prompts all the more reason for George to get her back as quickly as possible. You know, he was always in his correspondence very clear that he wanted this pursuit to be discreet, that he didn't want to antagonize Northern sensibilities about slavery. And it did. It was it stood in stark contrast to the benevolent slave owner that Washington painted himself to be and that many others believed him to be.
Mm-hmm. And that aspect I find incredibly fascinating, because George Washington himself years earlier had signed the Fugitive Slave Act, mm-hmm. which legally sort of gave him a legal avenue to find Ona Judge and follow some set procedures to have her taken back from New Hampshire to Mount Vernon. Yet he chose to sort of delicately subvert that, or at least try to. Tell us a little bit about his relationship with his own law, the Fugitive Slave Act.
Yeah, he signs this law in 93 and Ona runs away in 96. So it's 3 years later. And, you know, we can dance around it, but the reality is he broke the law. He broke his own law, which is even more kind of amazing. There was a process that was put in place for the retrieval of runaways. There were magistrates and attorneys that were to be called upon, and they were to oversee this process. An enslaved person had to be identified. And so there was a process. And Washington was clear. He was not interested in a process. He wanted it to be done discreetly, quickly, for as little money as possible.
Right. That process would have been super public, and he wouldn't have wanted that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So he made a couple of attempts through a couple of different folks. A caller made reference to Bassett mm-hmm. earlier, but that was the sort of second attempt. The first one was made by a man named Joseph Whipple, mm-hmm. who was Portsmouth's customs collector at the time. That was an appointed position. And George Washington tapped this guy to make the first attempt to bring Ona Judge back. Tell us about how that went.
Yeah, this is also a moment where we understand what a lame duck president, the
right.
difficulties of a lame duck president, that George Washington was on his way out of office. So Ona runs away in May. He knows where she is by August and makes this decision to go after her. So he calls upon, actually first it was the Secretary of the Treasury. And the Secretary of the Treasury reaches out to the customs collector and says, look, Washington's enslaved woman has run off, or really Martha's, and can you help get her back? And of course, the customs officer, who is an appointed official, he was appointed by the governor, who had talked this over, of course, with the president at first. So Governor Langdon,
was friends with Washington
and friends with Whipple, mm-hmm. appointed him as customs collector. And Whipple said, of course, I'll do whatever I can to help. but he is really sort of reluctant to do so. And we see this really sort of important encounter between him and Ona Judge that reminds us that Americans are starting to really rethink slavery. And clearly it's happening here in New Hampshire. And so you would think that anyone would do the president's bidding and would run off and, I don't know, throw a bag overhead, capture. They'd figure out where she is very quickly. You know, it's kind of hard to hide when you're a black person in Portsmouth in 1796. There
right,
were so few people.
Apparently there were fewer, forgive me if I'm not quoting your book correctly, but you said there were fewer free black people in Portsmouth than there were slaves in Mount Vernon.
Yeah.
So this interaction with Whipple, where basically he says, come to the docks, we'll make this orderly transition back to Mount Vernon, and what happens?
So there's he actually lures Ona with the offer of employment, says he's looking for someone to help at home and his wife. And Ona, of course, who needs employment, constant employment, she bites. And quickly it becomes clear that he is not who he says he is, and he is one of the president's agents. And what happens is Ona does not actually badmouth the president, but she says, look, I want to be free. And Joseph Whipple decides, you know, let me help you negotiate this. Let me help you talk to the president. Maybe we can get him to agree to free you, that maybe he can free you, if not now, then perhaps when he dies. And that's a way to negotiate. And so here's Ona and the customs collector, right? A 22-year-old black woman, the customs collector, negotiating with the president of the United States. And basically, Whipple writes back and says, well, she'll come back if you set her free. And Washington says, absolutely not. What kind of precedent would that set for the others who are enslaved? And when it becomes free, clear that he will not play ball, he will not emancipate her, Whipple steps away from, he is not interested, and he basically tells the president, well, you need to get your lawyers up here. If you want to get Ona back, I think you're going to need to follow the law.
Mm-hmm. And shortly before he dies, President Washington dies, he sends another sort of emissary, Martha Washington's nephew, the caller referenced earlier, Burwell Bassett. Mm-hmm. And this, as you describe in this book, Never Caught, it's so dramatic. I can see how it would be fodder for a play like the one our caller talked about. Tell us about the interaction with between Ona Judge, who was Ona Staines at that point, she was married, and Burwell Bassett Jr.
Yeah, so by the time that Bassett arrives in 1799, Ona's married. She has a child, and so the stakes are higher because not only is she a fugitive, but now her child is as well, because her status is what set the status of her child, not the fact that her father was free. And so it's interesting because Bassett comes and he actually stays with Governor Langdon. And for a long time, you know, Governor Langdon has had this kind of reputation of being the person who kind of told Ona, be careful, there's someone here looking for you. And, you know, I kind of I take a moment to question that because in actuality, it was Governor Langdon who told the Washingtons that Ona was here. And so back in 1796, he alerted them as to her presence in Portsmouth. And so Bassett comes, he stays with them, he attempts to kind of smooth talk Ona into coming home.
He shows up at her door.
Shows up at her door and says basically, oh, you know, we promise we'll be kind, you'll come back. And she resists again. She says no. And she's able once again to count on the help and assistance of the free black population in Portsmouth and its environs to help her run off again, and he's unable to find her.
Mm-hmm. And she runs off to the nearby town of Greenland, where she stays with a friendly family, the Jacks.
Yeah,
and they are able to support her, and they lean on each other to a certain extent for many years.
They do, and you know, part of clearly this is Ona's story, but what I wanted this book to be was a way, a lens to look at the beginnings of this nation through the eyes of the enslaved and through the eyes of a fugitive and through the eyes of free blacks, and to look at how difficult life was for these people, regardless of your status as free, enslaved, or fugitive. And when she takes refuge with a free Black family, the Jacks in Greenland, we see how freedom exists in by law for the Jacks, but life is extremely difficult. And so it begs the question, how free is free when slavery exists in the same nation? How free is free when you know you can be captured, sold into slavery, or kidnapped, having never been a slave? That, you know, what I wanted to do with this book was to show Ona's life, but also the lives of the people around her, and just how difficult it was to negotiate freedom.
And really quickly, Erica Armstrong Dunbar, as part of your research, you visited what is believed to be Ona Judge's grave here on the seacoast. What was it like?
Yeah, her final resting place. There's no marker for her grave. It's the home of the Jacks family. It's on private property. So I respect the property, the owners. So I don't sort of give that location up. But it was a moment where I was finishing up the book, and a good friend, a woman who's become a friend, Vicky Poland now. She's an enthusiast, an Ona Judge enthusiast, and she took me through lots of poison ivy into the forest to where we believe her remains are. And it was a sort of important moment for me. It helped me to bring the book to a close, to look at the surroundings, the environment, to smell, to feel the place where Ona spent so many years. And really, she was a fugitive, but I don't think she ever wanted to be forgotten.
Well, Erica, thank you very much for speaking with me and telling us all about Ona Judge.
Thank you.
That's Erica Armstrong Dunbar. She's the author of Never Caught: The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave Ona Judge. And listeners, remember, our conversation continues online on Facebook and nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello, thankful to Laura Kanoy for letting me sit in her chair today. It's been a pleasure, and thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.